and he is the most dangerous of them all. None of them acknowledges him, not even Vaux. Dantine takes his place with the other menials and slaves, standing in the hot dust, summoned, he assumes, to listen only. Garstag, who still has layers of blood on his gauntlets, is speaking.
"It's a big world," he says.
The speech is the guttural, halting Mortaic. Dantine has given up marveling at how he understands all of these things.
"We could use it."
Slurt laughs.
"It's a dust bowl. There's nothing for us here. It could feed us for as long as we wanted," says Garstag. "We could rebuild here."
"For what?" asks Clado.
"He likes the earth under his feet," says Philemon.
Dantine watches them intently. His pervasive sense of horror is inevitably fading. You can't stay terrified forever, and in its place come other things. Contempt, anger, even fascination.
"Tell us where we are," says Clado.
The surgeon's voice is soft, a dry whisper. Philemon draws out parchment from bags and satchels slung across his armour. The tallyman is possibly the strangest of the lot, burdened with lengths of mouldering vellum and long lists of scrawled names. His movements are hesitant, almost bumbling, though presumably he is as lethal as the rest of them when he needs to be.
"My charts are old," Philemon says. "They will be inaccurate, but we are deep into Imperial territory. We have a number of choices. One, we bring gifts to this world and make it our own. Two, we strike out on our original course, making for Ultramar. Three, we do something else."
Dragan paces at the rear. His energy is in contrast with the rest of them, who are virtually static.
"What are we thinking in this?" he grunts. "Drifting aimlessly?" "We never had the luxury before," says Slurt. "Choice, choice, choice. Too much of it will kill you."
The putrefier has something crawling up his leg. Dantine knows that these things are called Little Lords, and he is still mystified as to what their purpose is, or why they are tolerated. They are disgusting sacks, ranging in size from a fist's clench to a full lung. They strut and caper like foul infants, letting loose gouts of flatus or breaking into vicious little fights. And yet, Slurt reaches down for it now, picking it up gently. It settles into the crook of his arm, gurgling contentedly.
"Oh, we forget all this," offers Clado. "The despoilers' fleets must still be closer to us than the Primarchs."
There is division between them. Dantine finds himself compelled by it, drawn into it. The air seems to darken around them, to grow colder, and for a moment he imagines just what it would be like if these monsters took it upon themselves to fight one another. Vaux raises his hand.
"You would be bored quickly by this world, Garstag," he says.
The siege master's voice is the oldest, the deepest, the most avuncular, and the most reasonable.
"Solace is stuffed with supplies. We will not need more for months."
The others are listening, some more than others.
"This is not the Imperium we are used to," Vaux goes on. "The beacon is extinguished. Its defenders are scattered. Perhaps there is still fighting at Cadia. Perhaps not. We are used to being hunted out here. We will have to become used to being hunters."
Dragan snarls.
"We have always been..." "I know, brother," says Vaux. "Listen to me. Sabatine is the target."
He lets that sink in. Dantine feels hollow inside. He tries to remember where it is, how far off it is, whether there is any way a warning could be given. In the past, he might have considered a world like Sabatine to be impregnable, But that was before he met these creatures. Philemon is looking at his master.
I know the name. I know what is on Sabbatine.
Garstag is suddenly animated.
Is it within range? A fortress monastery, murmurs Slurt. It would be a worthy way to end your life, Siege Master, but look around you, Vork says. Where are they? A year ago, they would have been on our tails. We would have been fighting for our lives, ready to hurl Solas back into the warp. If they live yet, they are weak. The moment may not last. We must seize it.
Najan's winds moan around them, kicking up their familiar haze of husks and dust.
To end a chapter, says Slurt.
There were a lot of chapters at Cadia, says Clado. Maybe they didn't come back.
Possible,
says Garstag, his words sliding out carefully, as if he is chewing on them.
But still, a fortress monastery, nothing easy about it. It would be a world to remake, Cardain Master, Vork says. You would have true foundations there.
He turns to Dragon.
What say you, Gallowsman?
And then, Dantine understands what this is about. It is as if he sees the scene through Vork's eyes. The Siege Master has his heart still, dripping in that foul bag, and thus they are linked by the sorcery that prevents him from expiring as he should. Vork is daring Dragon to refuse. He is showing him a prestige target, a target worthy of any warband in the galaxy, and daring him to prefer the Despoiler's Road. And he does this knowing it will take them further into the galaxy's heart, a little closer to the destination he truly covets. Politics never alters. The outer visage may vary, from austere patrician to worm-eaten sadist, but the core concern remains the same. This is about power. Dragon knows it, too. All eyes turn to him. For a moment, Dantine detects uncertainty, just for a heartbeat.
They could be down to a tithe of their strength, Dragon says. It would still be hard, on their own ground. Yes, says Vork. Very difficult.
That is the challenge. That is the accusation of cowardice, just there, wrapped up in that slow, equable tone of voice. Dantine almost smiles. Dragon's head drops just a little.
I must lead the assault,
he demands, trying to claw something back.
That is your function, Vork says,
condescension swaddled in concession.
The ways of the warp are occluded,
interjects Philemon, sounding uneasy.
We are in darkness. To find this place will be another challenge, Vork says. But nothing is random in this universe, as you know, Taliman. We were brought here, and thus we have a guide.
They turn to Dantine without further prompting. Six pairs of green lenses, some angled, some round as navels, swiveling to focus on him. The effect is like a punch, and he stumbles back half a step.
You will take us to your old homeworld, won't you, Captain Dantine? Vork asks.
There is only one answer to the question. He no longer has a will of his own. He no longer has a life of his own. He is a puppet now, a shadow within a world of ghouls and mists. It matters not that he cannot read the warp, nor that he cannot pilot a starship. His soul clings to his body despite its mortal death, tracing a slender path across the dark firmaments of both space and time. They can use that. So he bows, like a slave bows.
Yes, Lord,
Dantin says, breaking just a little more inside. They leave Narjan with barely a backwards glance. The lifters boom off the fields, exploding the dry earth beneath their columns of fire. Unchanged crew members are herded back into shuttles and leashed to hooks before the doors are slammed closed on them. The servitors watch them go, those altered by Clado and the thousands more who never stopped working the fields. They lift their withered faces to the skies and see the pale lines of smoke arcing away. Then they return to their work, to hauling, planting, furrowing. They do not notice that the crops are dying now. They shamble through the rows of corn, their eyes as dead as the soil underfoot, following prescribed patterns hard-wired into their atrophied brain stems. Almost nothing is left behind but destruction and a slow grind of contagion that will spread and spread until the entire world is turned to silage. The only thing Vorks has placed on the surface is a wooden plaque nailed to a wooden pole. It reads, in standard Imperial Gothic, "Careless." The various landers return to Solus. They slip under the rotting eaves of the great ship, angling past trailing lines of solidified effluent. Solus excretes continually, a sludge of fecal brown that stains every orbit it has ever been in. Its many daughtercraft know how to evade this and dock without being inundated, though Najan's orbital zone is now tainted with the long arcs of spore mats. An air of expectance gradually permeates through the lower levels. Forges that have been out of action since the engagement are kindled again, and their cauldrons bubble into life. Hundreds of unbroken are garrisoned on the ship, and few were given leave to make planetfall. They are simmering now, surly and impatient for killing. The main engines ignite. Turgid Prometheum slops down the pipes. Solus wheels on its center, then grinds out of orbit, pushing powerfully into the cold. The plasma trains wheeze towards full power, and soon the ship is surging through the void, picking up speed. The Mandeville points are still hours away, but Tiafa's pod-locked navigators are roused by Brainspike and dragged, half-conscious, to the amniotic vats. Philemon returns to his sanctum. He has lists of bodies to collate and maps to consult. There were no fresh plagues discovered on Najan, so his tasks are light. As he descends, the weak light bleeds away to soft darkness. He almost misses the figure waiting for him at the base of the stairwell, standing entirely motionless, a clot of perfect black amid imperfect gloom. He reaches for his long knife.
"Work to do, Tallyman," Slurt asks, edging into a faint lumen echo. "As always, putrefier."
Slurt is smiling under his threadbare cowl. His empty eye sockets gape.
"Are you a most faithful labourer?"
Philemon keeps his hand on his weapon.
"You creep around too much. This is not a safe ship." "No, not at all."
Slurt walks towards the entrance to the sanctum, halting before the locked doorway.
"Some parts more than others."
"What do you want?"
"You spoke to Vorks."
Slurt turns to face Philemon.
"He asked you to divine what happened after Agrippina. Any results yet?"
"Vorks does not know what he wants."
"He wants certainty."
"He'll be waiting a long time for that."
Slurt laughs.
"I fear for him, brother,"
he says.
"You know him. He's been a good enough master. He is devout. The alternatives for us would be tougher."
"When the augurs align, when I know the truth, I will speak to him. Him alone."
Slurt looks at the locked door.
"What do you keep in there, anyway?"
"You can't see through my walls."
"If I could, I wouldn't ask."
Philemon draws closer, edging the blade an inch from its scabbard.
"You're right," he says, his voice cold. "I have work to do."
Slurt does not move, not immediately.
"I speak to the fighters. I listen to what they tell me. Vorx needs to give them red meat soon. Something for them to turn sour and chew on. Ask them who they prefer to follow. Him or..."
"I don't want to hear it."
Slurt smiles and looks down.
"If you say so. But we're allies. Truly, I don't want to see change. Not yet."
"Your loyalty commends you.
Who moved the ship, Tallyman?"
Philemon pushes the blade back into his guard. Then he shoves Slurt aside and unlocks the door.
"We're on course again," he says. "Be thankful for that."
Then he's through, and the door thuds closed. Slurt remains where he is for a while, musing. Then he turns, silently, and stalks off into the dark. Vorx remains on the bridge for much of the period of transit. He oversees the ship being taken into the warp. He listens to its structure as the immaterium gnaws at it. He listens to the complaints of the bound demons, who fear their void-loose cousins more than any mortal does. He listens to the cracks, the booms, the heartbeats of distress. The cadre of navigators dies quickly. They were always weak, their mutant bodies riddled with the consumptive maladies of the warp-struck, but in the service of the Unbroken they collapse with often perplexing speed. Their seeing eyes go blind, their blood turns to molten lead. One of the greatest impediments on a real space raid is this weak link. Imperial navigators live short lives too, but they at least have their heritage of the houses behind them and captains who appreciate their services. The scions of the eye must make do with scavenged scraps, the mind weak, the heart sick. Now it is worse than ever. It has been said many times since Agrippina, but Vorx thinks on it over and over.
"The galaxy is cracked. Abaddon has destroyed it. Now we reave its bleeding corpse. We are the blowflies on its wounds. We will conquer nothing, only watch our quarry expire as we reach out to grasp it."
When he thinks these things, his mouth moves silently. 1, 2, 3, his lips say. He uses Philemon's arts to guide them when Tiafa fails. He speaks to the little lords who whisper truths into his ear. He presses his helm's earpiece up against the inner curve of the hull and listens for the cackle of Neverborn riding the hot currents outside. Thus they make progress. Vorx sees Dantine's life thread stretch away into virtual space, glittering like a line of silk. For as long as he keeps the mortal's beating heart close to his own rotting innards, this skein is apparent to him, just as other skeins are apparent from other humans he has soul-harvested. Vorx is old, and the universe is full of such wondrous things, if one knows how to uncover them. Even as his real senses decay and fall out of use, his gifts make up the lost ground. He does not see in color anymore, but he detects psychic harmonics as an auger detects background radiation. He does not experience the passage of time in a purely linear fashion any longer, but he feels its wrinkles and its missteps. He does not ask Dantine what took him from Sabatine to Najan, even though he could find out if he wished to. He allows the man to keep fragments of himself locked away, at least for now. One day, in time, Captain Dantine will tell Vorx all, and willingly.
4, 5, 6.
Progress is made. Solace crawls through the void like every Death Guard vessel has ever done, slowly, deliberately, ploughing a blunt furrow. They drop in and out of the warp as the travails of the navigators and the chitterings of demons dictate. There is no fixed point any more. There is only an echoing chasm, running away down to infinity's base, colourless, lightless, seething with malice. In such a dream place, the servants of the god and those of the other real gods have the advantage. They have arts denied to the enemy by superstition. They can swim in this, glide in it, wash themselves in it. For the others, for those who warm their freezing hands by the afterglow of the throne's failing warmth, it must be horror beyond all horror. Vaux sees things on that journey. He sees dead worlds turning in the dark, their seas turned to iron slag. He sees empty ships drifting, no lights, no heat signature, just tombs now, tumbling over and over. He sees the flicker of intelligences dance across the open void, something that was always forbidden by the law of reality.
7, 8, 9.
Most of all, the void is empty. The Imperium is empty. It has been scoured, harrowed. This is damage on a galactic scale. The pillars of creation are riven, and soon the foundations will crumble. There is no coming back from this. All has changed.
10.
He looks up. Hovik is shuffling over to a pictolens, her spine curving more than ever. Her forehead is nearly pressed into the deck below as she hunches. Drez-Uil is trying to divine something, his lips flecked with red spittle. The sensor relays are flickering, picking something up. It might be another empty hulk from the early signs, but Vaux already knows it will not be. He stirs and gets up from the throne. As he extends his rotten muscles, threads of unwoven ceramite stick to the seat and armrests, stretching thin. They break as he moves away and curl around his feet like lizards' tails.
"Weapons,"
he murmurs. It is the first time he has spoken for many days. The crew respond, hauling on chains, yanking levers, skating bone nodes across tally boards. Kodad's face appears floating in midair, shimmering from the effects of lithro and rippling like a sheet of thin plastic.
"Howitzer's priming, Lord,"
he reports.
"Is the gallows man with you?"
Vaux asks absently.
"Lord?"
"Never mind. All power to ranged guns."
Solace is already responding. Only some of its functions require crew. All across the outer hull, skin plates are rupturing, pushed apart by the maws of splinter guns. Torpedoes slip out from their gravid tubes, shiny from afterbirth, and are dragged into the orifices of launches. Void shields, blurry as clouds of midges, shrivel across the ship's physical limits and snap down hard. Slave crews ratchet the long howitzer snouts out, extending thick barrels through yawning gunnels.
"Magnify,"
says Vaux, coming to stand before a great circular lens. The glass is thick, syrupy, cracked, and faded. From within its depths, stars swim and pan. Then something is detected, and machine spirits greedily lock on. A mouthless station keeper, her ears trailing weak dribbles of slime, looks up from her console to stare at it. The ship is red, tinged with black. It is spiked like an urchin, and its raised back is crowned with towers. Its thrusters are fully lit, and they glow an angry crimson. It is like a blood clot spun out of an artery and thrown into the night to pulse and leak. Its guns are out too, row upon row, glinting brassily. Torches have been lit along its flanks. Naked flames writhe amid the vacuum, giving off no heat or smoke, twisting like bound souls. Vaux studies it. A name comes to his mind, suggested by the form and his diligent researches.
"Ayamanda," he says, softly. "Our cousins, the word-bearers."
The ship is turning flankwards, lining up broadside. It is a Styx-class heavy cruiser, a capable enemy. Solus might well be bigger, probably older, but the corruption of the eye makes the old void displacement and weapons capability ratings more or less redundant. On such ships, the difference between death and survival really depends upon who's on board. Unbroken warriors are arriving on the bridge now, stomping up from the corridors below. All are armed. All are ready. Their desire for combat is like a stink, a musk, a stale odor born of too long quarantine.
"Firing solutions calculated,"
reports Kodad from his distant cubbyhole, down in the oily, hellish murk of the galleries. The same procedures are being enacted on the other ship, Vaux knows. It would be a close-run thing. Both ships might be destroyed by a committed exchange. That would be a waste, given what little is known about anything anymore.
"Wait,"
Vaux says, letting his claw fist unclench.
"Wait."
He can sense the movement all across the ship. The entire hold is astir. Unchanged crew are reaching for whatever weapons they have. The wounds caused by the iron shades are still scabbed over, but Solus is ready to bleed again. Dragan's voice crackles over the comm.
"Boarding tubes ready,"
he rasps. He is so eager, always so eager.
"Wait."
Then the voice comes, ringing over the internal relays. It is bronze hard, the kind of voice used for chastisement and inspiration. It is cruel, though not without purpose. Cruelty is a creed for them, just as indulgence is a creed for the Lords of Silence. It performs functions, it greases wheels, it summons the gods out from their sullen dens and yanks them into actuation.
"What ship is this?" says the voice. "What banner and what purpose? We are ready to fire."
Vaux detects another comburst, urgent and angry, from Dragan. He shuts it down.
"Solus of the 14th Legion, the Death Guard," he says. "No banner but our own, no cause but that of the faith. Come now, there's no cause for firing. We should talk."
There is a long pause. The two ships drift closer, still a long way from unaugmented visual range, but increasingly close to the outer limits of weapons fire. Vaux watches it come in. It feels like he is reeling it, a fish on a line, its spines wriggling. He enjoys the image.
"On this ship," says the voice. "Very well." "Siege master,"
Dragan voxes.
"We are not savages,"
Vaux voxes back, keeping the exchange private.
"This is our galaxy now. We must start behaving like we own it." "They will kill you."
"They will not. In any case, I will have protection.
You will take
my most trusted servant,"
Vaux says, and closes the link. For all that, his sluggish hearts are thudding a little harder. He looks at the red ship and sees the pain etched on its every pinnacle. Ayamandar has traced agony onto the void, pressed deep like a long blade's pull across skin.
1, 2, 3, his lips say.
Chapter 11. The two ships come to a full stop and hang in empty space. As they circle slowly, nudged by the last vestiges of momentum, lights pop and spark in the emptiness around them. These are the lights of Neverborn, instantiating briefly, like unstable elements created in a laboratorium's accelerator. Sometimes you can catch a glimpse of them before they gutter out again. A mouth, an eye, the curve of a rib. This is the state of the void now. Dragan does not know if it is the case everywhere or just in this region. It is both unsettling and intriguing. The delegation takes a shuttle, a big, cumbersome old hulk with a top-mounted lascannon. It has the name of an old imperial world, Chatakta, still just about visible on its flanks. They might have chosen to accept the word-bearer's offer of a teleport locus, but even Vorx cannot quite bring himself to yield to the warp meddling of Lorgar's priest sorcerers. A ship will do. Then, if the worst should happen, at least they have their own engines and their own guns. Dragan is combat-ready, his body drenched in a hot flush of hyper-adrenaline. His power fist rests on his knees, the blades sheathed but poised. Garstag sits opposite, next to Vorx. Six of the Cardane make up the rest of the complement. They are all in their bloated and swollen Terminator plate, true giants of slaughter. Dragan wonders if he too will one day don such armour, or whether he will always value the relative mobility of his current protection, the kind he has worn since before the turn. To wear the Cardane's colours is to make an irrevocable choice. You do not step back from it again, for that armour will swallow you, mould you, and then consume you. Dragan cannot deny the raw power of it. He has seen Garstag absorb punishment that should have levelled a dreadnought, but there is always a price. The older Dragan gets, the more he matures and steeps in the brine of killing, the more he understands that everything is transactional. The gods, the demons, the magisters of the Imperium, even the empty husk on the throne, they are all barterers and hucksters, trading a little of this for a soul full of that. You wish for power? Give me your memories. You wish for strength? I will take your tears. Vorx would not recognize that picture. The Siege Master thinks of things in older terms, more fundamental verities, and has a pious mind. For all the many pettier disagreements between Dragan and him, that perhaps is the greatest divide. Dragan turns away to look at the approaching ship. He admires its projected malevolence. Solace, from a distance, looks like a festering liver. This vessel looks like a flayed spinal cord, twitching and vivid. The shuttle glides in across a cityscape of chapels and bone towers, and he sees iconography hammered onto every surface. The octed is ubiquitous, beaten into iron and nailed to steel. It crowns cupolas and campaniles. It furnishes the mouths of the ship's macro cannons. It gazes out across long trenches filled with snaking energy arcs. He can hear chanting. That is impossible, of course, for the shuttle is still within the void. But he can hear it, all the same, a drone that echoes from tower to tower. Overlapping choirs are knocking out a dirge that he guesses has been going on for as long as the ship has been occupied. It is a grim, joyless sound. It is a product of rote and discipline, and it is not enjoyable to hear. Then again, at least those wretches have vocal cords. That is not always true of the unchanged on Solace. The shuttle docks high up on the prow-facing flank of the largest tower, which juts from the ship's upper hull amid groves of curved brass and barbed silver. The ornamentation is extravagant. A cavalcade of pillars and gold filigree screens, crowned with engraved demon faces and crouching gargoyles. When the doors open, a thick haze of incense sighs over them. The aroma is oppressive, a saccharine cocktail over bass notes of bodily frenzy. They are taken from the hangars by red-armoured escorts who do not speak. The interior of the ship is lit by flame, the corridor plates black and glistening. Dragan sees altars everywhere, stained and streaked with old blood. He hears cries from below that echo up long shafts, competing with the omnipresent chanting, to make the auditory environment as intimidating as possible. In glimpses, as the delegation passes high windows, he sees long naves stretch off into the darkness, all housing crowds of shuffling, robed supplicants. It is as crowded on this ship as it is sparse on Solace. The word-bearers have always valued fecundity. They reach their destination. An octagonal chamber with high Gothic arches, black-beamed and drenched in cold blue shadow. Candles flicker in narrow alcoves, piled with melted wax like milky tumours. A battle standard hangs above them, burned at the edges, but with its imagery and legend still just about visible. 17th Legion, the Imperial Heralds. That is a strange relic. One celebrating a name that most of Lorgar's sons have long since learned to despise. Higher up, where the air becomes hazier due to the burning senses, many bodies hang. One of them is dripping still, a faint pit-pat that bounces on the stone floor. Their hosts are waiting, 20 of them, all in full battle-plate of dark crimson and black. Their armour is as ornate as the ship's, riddled and crusted with complex sigils of allegiance and fidelity. Every one of those warriors has an intricate relationship to the warp-bound, a lattice of entreaties and bargains made with the intelligences, all written out in threads of spun gold and deftly woven down into the ceramite ground. One of them burns with the demon mark, his outline blurred and jumpy. Another has a leather-like mask stretched tight across his faceplate. Dragan thinks it probably isn't leather. The foremost of the group has a helm crowned with splayed veins and a long, ragged cloak. His faceplate is burnished gold and fashioned in the style of a gaunt death's head. He carries a crozius at his belt, a heavy item that pulls tight on its chains. Like all members of the old legions, he is gigantic now, his already outsized frame burgeoned and extended by the noxious stimulation of a life lived in hell. Every so often, a thin gauze of dark flame gusts and ghosts across the marked faces of his armour, as if he teeters on the knife-edge between the seen and the unseen.
"Mor Jalchek," he says, in that same cruel voice. "Apostle of the Weeping Veil."
Vorx bows. Set next to such tarnished finery, the siege master looks slumped and dirty.
"Vorx," he says simply, "the Lords of Silence. We give ourselves these names," Mor Jalchek says. "Or they are given to us. What are you doing here?"
Vorx thinks on a response. Dragan knows that the siege master will be smiling wryly under that heavy helm face, inasmuch as his lips still have independent function. He hates that. This is not a place for smiling. These are serious warriors, steeped in the blood of the Imperium, and they must be made respectful.
"We do not ask for leave to travel the void," Vorx says in the end. "You were at Agrippina," Mor Jalchek says. "As were you, I think. It seems the fates have driven us to the same place." "We were driven here by no one. There is prey in the void now." "Not very much of it," Vorx says. "The angels of death are all gone."
"Oh, no!"
Mor Jalchek's lenses flicker briefly with a reddish, deep-set tinge.
"You seem ignorant, cousin, so let me enlighten you. The fleets we fought over Cadia are not yet destroyed. They have been driven far from the gate's edge, but they fight still. Chapters are answering the call, racing to staunch the wound before it splits apart completely. But they are blind now. Their throne leash has been cut, and they stumble in the darkness. We pity them. We come to bring them to the light."
Garstag, standing on the far side of Vorx, let slip a guttural snort.
"You find this amusing?" Mor Jalchek asks calmly. The cruelty in his voice never wanes. "This is a moment of crisis. It will not come again. We reap now, here, so that we will not need to do so a second time."
"You are a speaker of the truth, Mor Jalchek," Vorx says. "I have met many of your kind, and they were all truthful. In that, we have some sympathy, if in little else."
His fingers stray briefly to the many bags clustered at his belt.
"We were
lost for a time. The warp's winds were not kind. Now we travel in these strange places, and our trail takes us to the masters of the kingdom.
More Jalchek nods.
What remains of them?
You hunt them yourself.
Our sacred task.
More Jalchek gestures. A brief flick of a taloned finger, and one of the wall panels hisses open. The thick metal lifts, bifurcates, then slides apart on a squeal of runners. Steam spills over the threshold, and wisps of engine smoke perspire from runnels on the far side. A void is revealed, lost in shadow and smog. Something is hanging in the murk, shivering a little. It is hard to make out what, exactly, for grave damage has been done to it by expert hands. There are tubes wrapping it now, all gurgling with fluids. There are hooks and barbs and serrated saws. It glistens. It weeps. Only one item is distinct, lodged amid the disturbing flotsam like a gem cast amid filth. The half-moon remnant of a pauldron. Vaux is a connoisseur of such things, and recognizes Mark VI Corvus plate, carefully tended, evidently old, now chipped and dented, but with the insignia still visible amid the bloodstains, a royal blue eagle's head on an ivory ground.
"This one failed to see the light," Moore Jalchek says, with possibly genuine sadness.
"Evidently.
Even reduced, they do not talk easily. However many we take, we have still found it difficult to find the path."
"We could help you with that."
Moore Jalchek turns to Vaux, interested for the first time.
"How so?"
"This path, out of them all, is clear to us. Come to Solace, and you will see it. We are both close now, though not so close that you would be bound to find it without assistance."
Dragan almost interjects. This is not a transaction, he thinks. This is not a bargain. This is just giving away possessions.
"Why?"
Moore Jalchek says.
"Think of the numbers," says Vaux. "Think of what you attempt. These are not fragile troops. They man their own walls. They have nowhere else to go. Even with these two great ships of ours, it might be difficult. With one, either one, perhaps impossible."
There is a principle here, one that goes back to the days of Horus. Imperial institutions are, admittedly, like cats in a sack, mauling one another over resources and prestige, though they will fight alongside one another well enough when the tactical necessity becomes apparent. For those on the other side of the Long War, however, things are less clear-cut. They have been known to claw at rivals even as the greater enemy looms up behind them. Hatreds vary in intensity, and those shared between rival gods can become incandescent. It was the greatest mark of the Despoiler's power that he was able to bind them all together for so long, and he is a long way away now. So they wait. They watch.
"The world has been marked for conquest," says Moore Jalchek. "The Pantheon demands it."
"Well, I am sure my own small part of the Pantheon would agree," says Vaux. "I do not think we are at odds here."
They wait again.
"What is your greater purpose?" asks Moore Jalchek.
"The same as yours, to bring lost souls to the light."
"To your limited, decayed creed?"
"Now then, no need for insults."
Moore Jalchek radiates an aura of extremity. His armor is a thing of excess. His ship is a cathedral to pain. For him, compromise is a sin, an alliance the first step to moral turpitude. Dragan watches to see which instinct will win out within him. the desire for his enemy's destruction, or the pride in solo accomplishment that surely drives him. Perhaps he has promised this world, Sabatine, to some power of the Empyrean. Perhaps he will sacrifice its inhabitants to bring some greater force into the world of the senses. Vaux must know this. He must know what a dangerous game is being played.
"I will consult," Morjalchek says at length. "I will contact you. In the meantime, stay on your ship."
"Where else would we go?" says Vaux, sounding amused.
"Nowhere. Not without speaking to me."
The tone of presumption borders on the absurd. Garstag hisses, moving his weapon a finger's width closer to deployment. Vaux is unmoved, though. He chuckles. Chuckles. A soft, gurgling sound that resonates within the caverns of his armor. Somehow, that sound diffuses things. It makes it impossible to take all this pomposity seriously, and that, Dragan has to admit, has a certain tactical value.
"Very well, Apostle of the Weeping Veil," Vaux says,
amusement still dancing across his stolid words.
"Think on it. Consult whatever augurs you employ. I trust you are wise enough to see what the gods have placed before us, and will know what to do with it."
The tone is so affable, so emollient. It makes Dragan want to snarl, and he clamps the instinct down.
"So, we take our leave now," Vaux says, offering a stiff half-bow. "But I am sure, very sure, that we will speak again soon."
"They will betray us," says Dragan.
"Yes," says Vaux.
"They have been commanded to take the world," says Dragan. "They will not stop until it is theirs."
"Yes."
"Then why are we doing this?"
Back in the shuttle's crew bay, Vaux regards Dragan. Despite everything, he still likes the warrior. He remembers when he first saw him fight. He remembers the boundless energy spun tight around limbs that seemed capable of pile-driving through rockcrete. He knows almost as much about Dragan's early years in the Death Guard as Dragan does. He knows even more than Dragan of his past life as a servant of the throne. For a long time, Vaux thought of him as something like a protégé, a potential successor to Garstag once the Cardane Master's time was ended. Maybe a trusted war counselor. A part of him grieves that Dragan now wishes to kill him and assume command of the warband. Another part of him understands that this is just the way things are. The will of the god must be maintained and exalted in all things, and he would not dream of confronting the threat openly. There are ways that these things are done, methods of retaining the allegiance of the unbroken, and those who flout the old laws soon die from them. For all that, he must find a way of channeling Dragon's ambition soon. He knows what the rest of his followers think. He knows that less than half now see him as their best hope for conquest. That situation cannot be allowed to continue.
"Because you are right, gallowsman," Vaux says. "Despite everything, a fortress monastery might very well be beyond us. Even if fewer than 100 white consuls still man it, we might dash ourselves against its walls in slaughter. We might lose. They might burn Solace. That would strike at my soul. The Weeping Veil are strong, and so, together, I see a cleaner victory."
"They will cut us deep when they can."
"Then we will have to be quicker."
Vaux leans forward, feels his old organs slosh around within his ceramite hide.
"You are the one who can do this. You retain what the rest of us are losing."
He places his calloused hand on her calloused knee, and feels the remnants of cartilage pop and slither.
We need to fight with our feet on the ground. We need a prize worthy of the god. It would be a waste to burn out our guns on these true believers.
Dragan looks at him for a long time. His entire body, still lean, radiates distrust. That huge fist, blistered with sores and bearing talons the length of a man's arm, twitches. Garstag is pretending not to listen. The rest of the Cardane affect the same disinterest. By ancient convention, the Honor Guard have forsworn involvement in the Warband's power games. But that fools no one. Garstag no doubt has designs on the command throne himself, though he would be a weak candidate, and possibly even knows it.
"You test me, Siege Master," Dragan says. "We are all tested," says Vaux. "That is the great lesson. It will never stop, whoever takes this world."
"But sometimes I do not think..."
He does not finish that statement, perhaps wisely.
"Trust me," says Vaux. "Our paths are leading to the same summit. In time, you will see that."
The shuttle shakes. Solus is above them now, a huge shadow cutting out the meager light of lost stars. It will gobble them up soon, fold them within its great cavities. Dragan looks away. His expression is the same as it always is, a snarl and a grimace of ceramite moulding, the vestiges of an Imperial Terror template slowly morphing into something softer. Vaux admires him. He admires his struggle to retain what he was, to take on the advantages of the Legion without accepting its temptations. It is a doomed struggle, and one day he will fail, but the attempt is valiant nonetheless.
"It will be conquest," Dragan says at last, grudgingly. "What we were made for. I will summon Naum, if you can. Be wary, though. It has been a long time."
Dragan looks at him. Vaux can sense his bafflement then, honestly held, unfeigned and unhidden.
"What do you want, Siege Master?" Dragan asks.
For a moment, the question floors him. He has not been asked it for a long time, but now he feels that it lurks everywhere, on everyone's lips. The universe has long since been a place where wants are never indulged. It has been needs for millennia, the endless grind of survival, plunder, the harrying run from bolt hole to bolt hole. But Dragan is right. There are choices now, a tyranny of them. They demand better answers, new answers, ones that may not issue from the mouths of Primarchs.
"I want the games to end," Vaux says,
almost to himself.
"I want the struggle to cease. I want the truth to be recognized. But the games have no end. All there is the game."
That is the orthodoxy, spun out of a lifetime in the eye's endless churn. There will always be four gods, it is said, balanced against one another in perpetual contest, toying with the mortal plane and raging with the immortal. That is why Dragan envies the Despoilers' hordes. He envies the Word-Bearers and their undivided allegiance. He does not yet fully understand Vaux's true belief, the reason why he has never taken an order from anyone but Mortarion. There is a hierarchy, even across the great game. Desire, knowledge, rage, these are the lesser things, the subordinate things, the ones that came later. Before them all was despair and succor and the slow release into abandonment. This was what came first, the primordial slop from which all else arose, only then to float like phantasms over it. In the end, despair will prevail again. In the end, every world will be a plague planet, and the tide of decay will once more lap at the foundations of reality, drowning all else.
"Do not believe everything you are told,"
Vaux says, watching as the viewports go black and Solace's old smells permeate the shuttle interior again.
"There are still possible victories, and if I read the entrails right, this is where they start."
Chapter 12. For a while, the two ships drift alongside one another in silence. It is an odd configuration. Two giants of the deep, both armed to the gunwales, holding position with their cold thrusters yawning and empty. The Iomander runs with constant light, a strobe of reds and oranges along its spiked hull. Solace is quieter, dripping with darkness, its blurred outline a haze of vegetative greens and greys. All around them, the void fizzes and blinks, as if electrified, and strange shapes part form in gasps of smoke, short-lived and misshapen. Dantine sees none of this. He is more mobile than before, limping from chamber to chamber, driven now by a curiosity that outweighs his fear. He estimates that there are thousands of men and women like him on this ship, probably tens of thousands. Few of them ever speak to him. As far as he can tell, few of them ever speak to one another. They seem strangely content, stumbling across the decks, just as he does. Some have tusks. Most do not appear to. This is a listless ship. And yet it functions, somehow. On a naval grand cruiser, this level of lassitude would have seen the captain executed and the ratings given heavy beatings. The commissariat would have come in, sweeping level by level, restoring fear and efficiency, getting the chains of command pulled taut again. The people here are not afraid. Some are sick, very badly sick. Most are carrying obviously terminal diseases, and their bodies are falling apart, but they are not afraid. Dantine begins to realize it has been a very long time since he has been among people who do not possess fear. He resists the urge, the dangerous urge, to think of this as a good thing. It is likely, he reflects as he wanders the decks, that this ship, this Solace, has a self-perpetuating community, much as a big Imperial starship does. There will be children born in the bilges, raised in the sticky darkness, learning a trade in the shadows. There will be strange hierarchies. The upper decks, unimaginably far off and prestigious. The gun gangs and ammunition haulers, an aspiration. The shit shovelers and slop servers, the likeliest occupation for any who survive the knife fights of the underdeck. They brawl with one another, and jostle, and protect, rot, perhaps even love. Then they die. All is done in the stink, the dark, the heat. This is an alien world, as alien as Dantine has ever encountered. The filth is phenomenal, burned deep into every surface, so that it feels less like an incrustation, and more like the very matter of the world around them. And yet, these souls persist here, against all odds, eking out short and strangely fecund lives before the phages bite, after which their superannuated bodily remains are scraped into boiling vats and served up to the next unknowing generation. He tried to speak to them a while back. He thought it might help if he exchanged a few words. Deep down, a part of him even thought that he might be able to find a few whose spirits had not been crushed, and he had visions of raising some kind of rebellion. He spoke to a woman first, tugging at her insect-eaten cloak and making her stop and look at him in the dark.
"What is your name?"
he asked. Her face was drawn, a pull of skin across bone, her eyes bulging like those of a mantis. She seemed unable to focus on him, and a line of black drool ran from her cracked lips.
47,
she said.
"That's your name."
48.
What?
49.
He found out, after that, that a lot of them count. They mutter away in the deeps, scratching for food or something cool to slap on their boils and sores, and they mumble numbers mindlessly over and over again. After that he found a man, perhaps his own age. He grabbed him by the shoulders